This is Radio 4, and now Trent's Last Case, another in our Murder for Christmas series.
Trent's Last Case by E.C. Bentley, dramatized by Alan Downer, with Martin Jarvis as Trent. The year is 1913.
Editor's office.
I have a call for Sir James on an outside line.
I'm afraid Sir James is very busy this afternoon.
The gentleman says he's secretary to Mr. Sixby Manderson.
In that case, excuse me, Sir James.
Yes, Silver, what is it?
A man who claims to be secretary to Sixby Manderson wants to speak to you. I've said you're busy, but...
Not so busy, I want to speak to Sixby Manderson's secretary.
Put the man on.
One moment, please. You're through.
Hello?
Sir James Molloy?
Speaking.
My name is Calvin Bunner. I'm speaking from the Manderson residence just outside Bishopsbridge.
How can I help you, Mr. Bunner?
I have some information for you. For exclusive use in your two newspapers. It's about Mr. Manderson.
Yes?
His body was found this morning in the grounds of this house.
His body?
He's been shot in the head.
Just a second, Mr. Bunner. Silver! Hunt up Figgis, a young Williams, the infallible Mrs. Morgan, and someone from the business section. Assemble them in the conference room now. Right, ladies and gentlemen, your full attention, please. Sixby Manderson has been murdered. Consequently, we'll be bringing out a special edition this evening and a full story in the Record tomorrow. Williams,
sir,
instruct Mr. Anthony to prepare for a two-column opening that will knock the town endways. Tell him to take all measures and precautions for a scoop. Say that Figgis will be over in 5 minutes with the full story.
Yes, sir.
And then come straight back.
Yes, sir.
You ready, Figgis?
Sir.
Sixby Manderson and his wife, with two secretaries, have been for the past fortnight at the house called White Gables at Marlstone near Bishopsbridge. He bought it 4 years ago, and he and Mrs. Manderson have been in the habit of spending part of each summer there. Last night, he went to bed at 11:30, as usual. No one knows what time he got up and left the house, but his body was discovered at 10 o'clock this morning by one of the gardeners. It was lying by a shed in the grounds of the house. He had been shot through the left eye, and death must have been instantaneous. Dr. Stock of Marlstone will conduct a post-mortem examination. So far, the police have no clue as to the identity of the murderer. Got that?
Yes, sir.
Well, knock some shape into it and we're away.
Yes, sir. How about this for a headline? Napoleon of Wall Street murdered.
How about murder of Sixby Manderson? Keep it simple.
Yes, right.
Anything else?
Yes. How about one of the ablest detectives at Scotland Yard has been put in charge of the case?
It's a safe statement. Why not?
And Mrs. Manderson, was she there?
She was.
But then how about some human interest? She's prostrated by shock and is seeing no one.
I don't think so, Mr. Figgis. Forgive me, Sir James.
Mrs. Morgan?
I once saw Mrs. Manderson, and she looked quite healthy and intelligent. She won't be prostrated by shock, I don't think. She'll be more likely to be doing all she can to assist the police.
I'm on my way, then.
Yes, cut along. Mr. Anthony's expecting you. And use his private office. At this stage, we can't be too discreet.
Sir.
Right, it's your turn, Mrs. Morgan. I expect you know what I want from you.
I did anticipate something of the kind, Sir James, so I've come prepared. Mm-hmm. Our Manderson biography is well up to date. Would you like to see it?
Please. And if you've a copy for Mr. Edison here.
Of course. It's a touch hyperbolic, perhaps. All that about having been the foe of the raiding chieftains that infest the borders of Wall Street.
Edison, what do you think?
Well, I'm sure of one thing. The moment this news gets out, the bottom will fall out of Wall Street.
Well, you'd agree with this, then. To speak the name of Manderson was to call up a vision of all that was broad-based and firm in the vast wealth of the United States.
Absolutely. They don't call him the Colossus for nothing.
That's not all they called him.
What?
Miners, steelworkers, cattlemen, tens of thousands of workers all across America and elsewhere had every reason to curse his name.
You smashed a strike or two, yes.
Using methods that were both ruthless and lawless.
Always in pursuit of legitimate business ends.
Forgive me, Mr. Edison, but only a finance editor would find that a valid excuse.
That's below the belt, Mrs. Morgan.
I assure you, Sir James, that none of my personal views about Manderson will find their way into his obituary. Shall we go on?
Please do.
You will see that the salient biographical details are as follows. Born in New York in 1860 and given the best education that money can buy. Mm-hmm. As a young man, went into business on his own account and soon won the dubious reputation of being an infant prodigy in the field of financial speculation. A gambler of genius, pitting his wits against all comers in the dogfight of the New York Stock Exchange.
And mostly coming out on top.
Quite. When his father died in 1889, Manderson took over the family banking business and changed overnight, turning his back on Wall Street and by hard work and keen brain, winning control of the company and a reputation as a pillar of the financial establishment.
A poacher turned gamekeeper, you might say.
In 1907, he met and married Mabel Domecq, an English lady barely half his age.
Mm.
There are no children.
And so on and so forth. Right, Mrs. Morgan, let's print it.
You said I was to report back, Sir James.
Yes, Williams, thank you. I just want you to stand by and give Mrs. Morgan a hand.
Yes, sir.
Have we any photographs?
No shortage of those. I'll send a selection down to you at once and you can choose.
Excellent.
We also have two very good portraits. One, a sketch by Mr. Trent, when they were fellow passengers on the same ship somewhere. It's a splendid likeness.
You know our public, Mrs. M. They always prefer a bad photograph to a good drawing. But on the subject of Trent, Silver.
Yes, sir.
Get him on the telephone for me now, William.
Yes, sir.
You're putting him on the case, Sir James?
I don't think he'll take much coaxing. Come along, Edison. We'll discuss the financial aspect as we go.
Right, Sir James.
Who is this Mr. Trent, then?
Philip Trent?
Hmm.
A painter. His pictures sell, what's more. Early 30s, handsome, full of fun.
A painter? So what have you got with him?
A few years ago, there was a murder committed in a railway train in very puzzling circumstances. Trent applied his mind to the case and later sent a long letter to Sir James because his newspaper had, as usual, contained the fullest and most intelligent version of the facts. Oh, pass me those photographs, would you?
Certainly.
And in his letter, Trent did what Poe had done in the case of the murder of Mary Rogers.
Oh, yeah?
With nothing but the newspapers to guide him, Trent drew attention to the significance of certain apparently negligible facts so as to throw grave suspicion onto a man who had presented himself as a witness. Sir James printed the letter and in the next edition was able to announce the arrest and full confession of the incriminated man.
Well, well.
Since then, Sir James has paid Mr. Trent large sums to unravel similar problems for the paper, at home and abroad. And he's been amazingly successful. However, Mr. Trent always returns to his painting.
Oh, let's hope he'll sell this one for us then, eh?
I'm sure he will. Sadly, if he travels by train, which is his usual preference, he won't be in Marston till breakfast time tomorrow. The only good train left half an hour ago. The next is a slow one leaving Paddington at midnight.
You know your Bradshaw by heart, do you, Mrs. Morgan?
A good newspaper man, Williams, is supposed to know everything.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes?
Yeah, you're Mr. Trent, aren't you? Mr. Philip Trent?
Yes, that's right.
I recognised you from your photographs. I'm a great fan. And something of an amateur sleuth myself. The way you solved that murder at Ilkley, I really don't know how you did it. Quite spectacular.
Oh, thank you. I'm afraid you have the advantage of me, Mr.
Abbott. Abbott. The Henry Abbott. I'm manager of the Castle Hotel. The newspaper telephone booked you a room. Said you'd be arriving on this train.
Indeed. And you very thoughtfully came to collect me. Well, I'm most indebted, Mr. Abbott.
All night journeys aren't much fun, are they? Oh, can I take your bag, sir?
Thank you very much. Oh, I'm quite fond of railway travelling, as a matter of fact. It has a certain appeal. I am the stoker and the stoked.
I am the song the porter sings.
Beg your pardon, sir? It's nothing, it doesn't matter. I am packed for a longish stay, I'm afraid. One never knows with these matters.
Are you immediately hungry for your breakfast, sir?
Why do you ask?
Because I... I thought you might like to drive to the hotel via Dr. Stock's surgery.
Oh?
It's the last chance you'll have to see the body. It's to be post-mortem this morning.
Are you able to arrange it?
It's a mighty regular, sir, but one is not without one's influence in the village. It's all laid on already, and the doctor is waiting.
As you'll observe, Mr. Trent, the shot in the eye scarcely disfigured the face at all and caused scarcely any effusion of blood.
Nor are there any powder burns visible, indicating he was not shot at close range.
Quite so, Mr. Abbott.
And, to my mind, eliminating the possibility of suicide.
Besides which, no weapon was found near the body.
And whoever heard of a suicide shooting himself through the eye?
Oh, good point, Mr. Trent, good point.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Abbott, thank you. Now, what interests me more are his wrists.
What about them?
You see these bruises and scratches?
I'd observed them, of course, at my initial examination.
Suggestive of a struggle, I'd say.
That's what it looks like. Also of interest are his shirt cuffs.
In what way, sir?
Well, with someone dressed as formally as this, you'd expect the cuffs to be well down over the wrists.
Perhaps in the struggle.
Possibly. Now, you gentlemen must have seen something of him on his previous visits to White Gables. Would you have called him a well-dressed man?
I'd have called him a swell.
Yes, he was always quite fastidious in his dress.
Because there's something else that's rather odd. Look at his shoelaces.
My word. Those laces were tied in a hurry.
That's my point about the cuffs. They're dragged up inside the coat sleeves as if he'd hurried into his coat without pulling them down. That's why the wrists are visible.
He parted his hair carefully enough.
Yeah, that parting's a work of art.
Also, if he was in a hurry, why did he put on so much? Complete outfit of underclothing, studs in the shirt, sock suspenders, watch, chain, money, key.
Why, indeed.
On the other hand...
What?
He'd neglected to put in his false teeth.
It doesn't add up.
And there's something else.
What?
His watch. It's in the wrong pocket. Look, one of the waistcoat pockets is lined with wash leather to accommodate a watch. But he'd put his into the pocket on the other side.
And what do you deduce from that?
Oh, nothing for the present, Doctor. I must reconnoitre the ground first. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for your invaluable assistance.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, I think it's time for breakfast.
My dear Trent, I was half expecting you.
Well, well, well. Nathaniel Burton Cupples. How are you, my best of friends?
I'm tolerably well, thank you. Oh, you're looking splendid. Will you join me for breakfast?
Oh, rather. I've worked up quite an appetite. Wait up. Yes. I'll start with grapefruit, and then I think the sole.
Yes.
But I shan't eat again till this evening, very likely. I expect this to be a hard day.
I take it you've come down to write about the murder.
Oh, that's rather a colourless way of putting it. I should prefer to say I'm here to hunt down the guilty and vindicate the honour of society. I've had one slice of luck already. I've been allowed to view the body. Now I must somehow manage to get on the right side of the people at the house.
Well, that is precisely the point on which I can be of assistance to you. Now, allow me to explain. Mrs. Manderson is my niece.
Cupples, are you jesting with me?
No, I'm perfectly serious. Her father, John Peter Domecq, was my late wife's brother. Now, she's bearing up wonderfully well, Trent. She has remarkable fortitude of character.
Grapefruit, sir?
Oh, thank you.
And will it be tea or coffee?
Tea, please. A large pot.
Very good, sir.
Now, will your niece allow me to see her?
Well, she has a great horror of the newspapers.
Yeah.
And is doing her utmost to keep journalists away. But I mentioned that you might be down and told her you were a personal friend. And it ended with her saying that if you should come, she would like you to be helped in every way. However,
yeah,
she will prefer not to see you herself just yet. She's keeping to her own sitting room. She's been interviewed by a detective from Scotland Yard and feels unequal to any more.
I quite understand.
Now, there are two secretaries and Martin the butler, who she thinks can tell you all you want to know.
Cupples, is there anything about this business that you know and would rather not tell me?
Well, what on earth do you mean?
I mean about the Mandersons. Is it... What strikes me as odd about this affair is that here is a man, a famous man, suddenly and violently killed, and nobody's heart seems broken. Doctor, hotel manager, been his neighbours for years, both spoke about him as coolly as though they never set eyes on him.
Well, the truth is that nobody liked Manderson, and those who were nearest to him liked him least of all.
See.
As for my niece, I know her to be an amiable and honorable woman, but for some time past, Manderson had made her miserable.
In what way?
She said it was as if he were nursing a perpetual grievance. He maintained a distance between them and would say nothing.
And this estrangement had been going on for how long?
Oh, several months. At last, a week ago, she wrote asking me to come down and talk to him on her behalf. She was adamant she wouldn't do so herself, so I agreed. I refused to go to White Gables, disapproving, as I do, of the use to which Manderson on several notorious occasions put his vast industrial power, so I watched my opportunity and met him as he passed by this hotel. We spoke just inside the gate there.
And?
Well, I told him what Mabel had confided in me and asked how he could justify his behavior towards her.
How did he receive that?
Not very well. He told me not to butt in. Said Mabel was well able to take care of herself, as he had found out, among other things. I insisted he explain. He refused. He said, this thing has gone far enough, I guess. And he turned to go.
Did he mean your interview?
Oh, you'd think so, wouldn't you, from the words alone. But it was the way he uttered them, and a fierce light in his eye. I received the impression he'd formed some sinister resolve.
Good heavens. What did you do?
I flew into a rage. I love my niece, and in the heat of the moment I said a number of foolish things at the top of my voice and within earshot of several of the hotel guests, concluding with a statement that I thought him unfit to live.
not very typical of you couples.
Well, at least it relieved my mind.
And Manderson?
Oh, he smiled slightly, but I could see a vein swelling in his forehead. It's not a pleasant sight. Then he turned away and strolled off towards White Gables.
And this happened...
on Sunday morning.
And you never saw him again?
No. Or rather, yes, once, later in the day, on the golf course. But I didn't speak to him. And next morning he was found dead. I tell you all this, my friend, because I fear that you will find it out for yourself and suspect Mabel of having had something to do with the crime, and that's simply not possible.
Ooh. So... thank you. Well, it'll be a shame to hurry this. It looks delicious. But I'm being paid a vast sum by Sir James to solve the murder. I must get over to White Gables.
What will you do first?
Visit the scene of the crime, I think. The spot where the body was found. Something might turn up.
Mr. Trent, I presume? Oh, did I give you a start? I'm sorry.
That's all right.
My name is John Marlowe. I'm Mr. Manderson's personal secretary.
Ah, yes.
Mr. Cupples telephoned from the hotel. You are expected.
Oh, good.
Have you found any clues?
Not one. I've ransacked the hut. I've covered every inch of the ground. Nothing at all. It's a terrible business, Mr. Marlowe.
Yes.
You look worn out.
I was driving the car all Sunday night and most of yesterday, and I didn't sleep well last night after hearing the news.
Who would?
Indeed. Listen, I'll have to leave you now. I have to arrange about the inquest. But if you go up to the house and ask for Mr. Bunner, he'll look after you.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, there's a detective here already. Inspector Murch from Scotland Yard.
Inspector Murch, eh?
He arrived yesterday. He's in the library.
You didn't waste any time, Inspector.
Ah, Mr. Trent.
I did think I was ahead of Scotland Yard this time. How did you get here so soon?
I was on leave with the missus at Halvey, 12 miles down the coast. I bicycled over yesterday evening.
So you have the head start.
Oh, I don't mind bringing you up to date. I know you'd do the same for me if the positions were reversed. Seen the body?
Oh, yes, yes, thank you. And the place where it lay?
You haven't wasted very much time yourself.
So, what are your first impressions?
It's all very puzzling. Now, to start with, I guessed it might be common robbery and murder by some tramp. But there's not the slightest trace of any attempt at burglary, and the body wasn't robbed. My second thought was suicide.
Ah.
But, as I'm sure you'll agree, Mr. Trent, the facts are all against it.
Hmm. So, who do you suspect?
Everybody. At this stage of affairs, it's the only safe principle. Now, First of all, there's Mrs. Manderson.
Yes?
Seems she and Mr. Manderson weren't getting along so well just lately. And she was the last person he spoke to as he retired for the night. They occupied adjoining rooms, you see.
You have looked over them?
Yeah. It's interesting. him being a millionaire, you'd think he'd have gone in for luxury. But his bedroom's bare, almost like a cell. It opens onto his wife's room. Now, not much of the cell about that, I can tell you. There's a lady who enjoys the pretty things in life.
Mm. What about this room?
Oh, they call it the library. Manderson used to do his writing in here. I've been through the desk this morning with the American secretary. Bunner, his name is, and a queerer card I never saw turned. Now, he's got it into his head that his boss had been receiving threatening letters and that the murder was the outcome of that.
Any evidence?
None at all. All we found were business letters, reports, prospectuses, and that's just what you'd expect.
Mm.
The only unusual thing we found were some packets of banknotes to a considerable amount, and a couple of little bags of unset diamonds.
Diamonds?
It seems Manderson had begun buying diamonds lately as a speculation. A new game, Bunner said. I told him to put them in a safer place.
Mm. Good. Now, what did Manderson want with two secretaries?
I asked him the same question. The arrangement was that Bunner was his right-hand businessman, one of his office staff, whereas Marlowe looked after his motors and yacht and horses and sporting arrangements and that.
I see.
The last member of the staff to see Manderson alive was Martin the butler. I had his story last night and very glad he was to tell it. A fair like this is meat and drink to the likes of him. Would you like to talk to him?
If it wouldn't bore you to hear what he has to say again.
Well, they say suffering is good for the soul.
I last saw Mr. Manderson.
No, please, not that yet. Tell me all you saw of him that evening. After dinner, sir.
After dinner, sir. Yes. I recall that after dinner, Mr. Manderson and Mr. Marlowe walked up and down the path through the orchard talking.
Have you any idea what they were talking about?
Well, it seemed important because I heard Mr. Manderson say, as near as I can remember, if Harris is there, every minute is vital. You want to start right away, and not a word to anyone. Mr. Marlowe answered, very well, I'll just change out of these clothes and I'm ready. Or words to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Marlowe then went up to his bedroom and Mr. Manderson came in here and rang for me. He handed me some letters for the postman in the morning and observed that Mr. Marlowe had persuaded him to go for a drive in the car by moonlight.
What time was this?
About ten, sir, I should say. Mr. Manderson then joined Mrs. Manderson in the drawing room, which struck me as curious, as I had not known him enter that room since we came to White Gables this year, preferring to remain alone in here. However, he did only remain with Mrs. Manderson for a few minutes. Then he and Mr. Marlowe drove off in the direction of Bishopsbridge.
And did you see Mr. Manderson again later?
About an hour later, yes, sir. And once again here in the library.
He rang for you?
Yes, sir. Said he wanted someone to sit up until 12:30 in case an important message should come through by telephone. And he requested me to do this since Mr. Marlowe had driven to Southampton for him in the motor. He said I was to take the message down if it came, but on no account was I to disturb him.
And that was all?
He ordered a fresh siphon of soda water.
Mm. You noticed nothing unusual about him? He didn't appear worried, ill at ease?
No, sir. When I answered his ring, he was seated by the telephone, and when I returned with the siphon, he was engaged in conversation over the wire.
Excuse me, sir.
What is it, Sergeant?
Dr. Stocks just sent something up for you, sir. Something private.
Ah, yes, right. Excuse me for a moment, Trent.
Yes, of course. To continue, do you remember anything of what Mr. Manderson was saying on the telephone?
Something about somebody being at some hotel.
Hmm. And that was the last you saw and heard of him alive?
No, sir. At about 11:30, I heard him go up to bed. I myself sat up till 12:30, as instructed, but no message came.
Sorry about that.
No, not at all. Martin, did you hear Mr. Manderson re-enter the house after returning from his drive in the car?
No, sir. His ringing the bell in this room was the first I knew of his being back. He must have come in by the French window.
If I may.
Inspector?
That does seem likely. There's a footprint in the soft new gravel just outside. It exactly matches the patent shoes Manderson wore that night.
I see.
And he still had his hat on, I remember, and had thrown his greatcoat over the end of that table where he'd placed a decanter of whiskey, a siphon and a glass. He kept them in that cupboard.
Was he a heavy drinker?
Oh, on the contrary, sir. He was a remarkably abstemious man.
This cupboard?
Yes, that's right, sir.
Yes. About the whiskey, did Mr. Manderson take a drink that night?
I couldn't say, sir. I know the decanter was nearly full that evening. I'd refilled it a day or so before.
It's half empty now.
How extraordinary.
Well, that's how it was this morning.
I don't understand it. Most days he never drank a drop.
The servants, perhaps?
Out of the question. The women servants never touch anything. I can answer for it. And when I want a drink, I can help myself without going to the decanter.
Thank you. Now, about Mr. Manderson's clothing. I suppose he had dressed for dinner that night.
Well, certainly, sir. He had on a suit with a dress jacket, which he usually wore when dining at home.
And he was dressed like that when you saw him last?
Oh, but the jacket, yes, sir. When he spent the evening in the library, as usually happened of late, he would change it for an old tweed shooting jacket. When I last saw him, he was wearing that.
I see. Now, to the following morning, I understand that Mr. Manderson was not missed until the body was found about 10 o'clock.
That is so, sir. Mr. Manderson was never called in the morning, nor did he have anything brought up to him. And quite often he would sleep till 9 or 10 o'clock.
And you yourself heard nothing in the night? No pistol shot, no sounds of struggle?
Oddly enough, sir, nothing. I am a light sleeper, and my bedroom is on the side of the house nearest to where Mr. Manderson's body was found, but no, I heard nothing.
Nor did you hear him leave the house at whatever time it was the following morning?
No, sir.
One final question. Were the clothes in which the body was found the clothes which Mr. Manderson would naturally have worn that day?
Another oddity, sir. I must answer yes and no. The brown suit was one of a dozen he might have worn, but otherwise...
Yes?
Well, he had put on all the same things he had worn the night before. Large-fronted shirt and all. It was quite unprecedented, and shows to my way of thinking what a hurry he must have been in when getting up, because normally...
Thank you. That is all for the moment. Though you can point us in the direction of Mr. Manderson's bedroom.
As you say, Murch, for the apartment of a plutocrat, it is strangely bare.
Here. It's all been left as it was on the morning the body was discovered.
Indeed. Bed unmade.
Oh, teeth and a glass on the bedside table. Scattered articles of clothing. Dressing table in some disorder.
As you might expect of a man who was dressing in a hurry.
Now, where are these patent leather shoes you spoke of?
In this cupboard, sir, right hand side.
And these?
Are the offending articles. Manderson left them outside the door as usual for the maid to clean.
She didn't clean them all that well. Look, and a faint trace of red gravel in the angle between the heel and the instep.
Yes, it matches the gravel outside the French window.
Where you found the footprint?
Correct.
That is strange.
What?
There's a slight split in the leather here, where the two laced parts of the shoe join the upper. Same in both shoes. Stitching is slightly parted.
Very slightly, yes.
Also, slight straining of the stitches where the uppers join the sole.
Well, as Martin said, he wore them every evening. You'd expect a certain amount of wear and tear.
Perhaps. Let's take a look next door.
It's another world in there.
Well, the lady has taste. Now, this separating door, was it opened the morning the body was found?
It was. let me just refer to my notes. Yes. The French maid Celestine brought up tea to Mrs. Manderson at about 7 o'clock as usual. Also, as usual, she shut the door between the two bedrooms so as not to disturb Monsieur.
So she came in from there and shut the door so, which means she couldn't see into her husband's room as she did so.
Correct. She could see nothing of the adjoining room. That is why it was assumed Manderson was still in his room while Mrs. Manderson was breakfasting, rising and performing her ablutions.
Did the maid also open the windows?
They were already open. Mrs. Manderson needed to sleep with plenty of fresh air. The maid merely opened the curtains.
Now, what sort of person is she, this maid?
French.
But a reliable witness.
No great ally of Mr. Manderson. She didn't like the way he'd been making her mistress unhappy. I don't regard her as a suspect, though.
Whom do you regard as a suspect, Inspector Murch?
If I'm pushed? Martin, the butler.
Ah.
At least as a preliminary theory. Now, as this. There's a plan of burglary. Say a couple of men in it and Martin squared. He's told them where the place is and all about the valuables in the drawing room and elsewhere. Martin leaves the French window in the library ajar, accidentally on purpose, and they walk in and sample the whiskey to give themselves Dutch courage. Now, Manderson isn't asleep yet, and hears them, thinks it's burglars, gets up very quietly to see if anything's wrong. He creeps down on them, they cut and run. He follows them, catches them up by the shed, there's a fight, one of them loses his head and makes a swinging job out of it. Now, you pick that to pieces.
Oh, very well. Just to oblige. First, no traces of burglars, and nobody hears anything of the stampede through the library or any shouts from Manderson inside or outside the house.
Oh, no.
Next, in your long experience, did you ever hear of a householder getting up in the night to pounce on burglars who dresses fully, underclothes, shirt, collar and tie, trousers, waistcoat and coat, socks and hard leather shoes, gives the finishing touches to his toilet by fastidiously parting his hair putting on his watch and chain? Any item he seems to have forgotten was his teeth.
I did say it was only a preliminary theory.
Where do the two secretaries sleep?
Their rooms are directly opposite. I'll show you.
Thank you. Don't tell me this is John Marlowe's room.
Got it in one.
I haven't met Mr. Bunny yet, but I somehow don't see his room as being full of golf balls and fishing rods.
there's only one thing of interest. It's in that leather case.
This one?
Open it.
A revolver.
With the initials JM engraved on the stock. John Marlowe. Now then, take a look at this. Dr. Stock just had it sent over for me.
Is it the bullet?
Found lodged in the bone at the back of Manderson's skull. Well,
could it have come from this revolver?
It could indeed. I know about firearms, Mr. Trent, and I can categorically state that it was fired by a weapon of this make and calibre. These marks were made by the rifling of the barrel, a barrel exactly like this one, and there is no other revolver which marks the bullet just like this.
This mystery is all wrong. Now, let's see where we stand. Marlowe was...
in Southampton. Yeah. Left about 10 o'clock and didn't return until many hours after the murder was committed.
You're sure?
Positive. I questioned him late last night. He arrived in Southampton about 6:30 on the Monday morning.
Now, is there any corroboration?
Oh, yes. I also wired our people in Southampton. Early this morning, I got this reply. Oh,
thank you. Person answering description in motor answering description arrived Bedford Hotel here 6 a.m. today, gave name Marlowe. Later inquired at Doxbury passenger named Harris on Havre Ferry, repeatedly until about 1:15 p.m. Left soon afterwards in car. Company's agents informed berth was booked name Harris last week, but Harris not on boat. Signed Burke Inspector.
You see? His own story borne out in every particular. Also, he sent a wire to Manderson. Harris not turned up, missed boat, returning Marlowe. It was duly delivered here in the afternoon and placed among the dead man's letters. In due course, Marlowe arrived back here dog-tired and nearly fainted when informed of Manderson's death.
It was unlucky for Manderson that Marlowe left his revolver and cartridges about so carelessly, don't you think? Wasn't that rather throwing temptation in somebody's way?
I wouldn't attach too much importance to that revolver if I were you. It's common enough over here. Calvin C. Bunner, at your service.
How do you do?
In fact, Mr. Manderson had one just like it. I expect you are Mr. Trent.
That's quite right.
You thought I might have been eavesdropping, perhaps? No, sir. I just heard a word or two about the revolver, that's all. It's what we call a little Arthur back home, and I dare say there are duplicates of it in 10,000 hip pockets this very minute. I consider it too light in the hand myself. I prefer something heavier. Feel that, Mr. Trent. Be careful. It's loaded.
Yes. Tell me, Mr. Bunner, did Mr. Marlowe have need of a revolver?
He bought it to please the old man. Manderson said it was ridiculous for a secretary of his to be without a pistol.
Oh, why do you think Manderson said that, Mr. Bunner? Did he feel threatened?
I believe he knew there was something coming to him, something he couldn't dodge.
Indeed.
There was a change in his manner these last few months. He was gloomy, sullen, as if he was everlastingly brooding over something bad, something he couldn't fix. Then a couple of weeks back, his self-restraint began to go. I'm the only man who knows it, but when he was alone with me in his office, if the least little thing went wrong, he'd fly off the handle. And this was a man who always kept himself well in hand. His calm was deadly. I never saw anything like it.
And nobody saw this side of him but you?
I guess not.
And you put all this down to some fear that somebody had designs on his life?
I do.
Who?
Oh, there was a whole crowd of dangerous men scattered up and down the states who had it in for him. I mean, take the Pennsylvania coal strike alone. There were 30,000 men who would have jumped at the chance of drilling a hole through the man who fixed it so they'd either starve or give in to his terms.
That was years ago.
So what? They'd been known to dynamite a man in Idaho who'd done them dirt in New Jersey 10 years before. And the Atlantic's not going to stop them.
Hmm.
Well, well, well. Well, I'm deeply obliged to you, Mr. Banner. Your theory is perfectly rational and appears to fit the facts. Now, my stomach says it's lunchtime, and whatever you're doing now, Mr. Trent?
No, just looking at Mr. Marlowe's shoes.
What about them?
Oh, nothing. They're just half a size larger than Mr. Manderson's, that's all.
Oh.
That's all. Shall we make a move? It's about 2 o'clock.
10 a.m. in little old New York. And I hope we never see anything nearer hell than what's loose in Wall Street this minute.
Good morning, my dear Trent.
Ah, good morning, my dear Cobbles.
They said at reception that you were still at breakfast.
No, it's almost finished.
Are you coming to the inquest?
No, I think not. I've still some work to do at the house. And I have little doubt that the good Dr. Stock will bring in a verdict of murder by person or persons unknown.
Oh, definitely not suicide, then.
Oh, no. This was a premeditated crime. An extraordinarily cunning one at that.
Huh?
Well, I'm ready now. Shall we walk up to White Gables together?
Yes, by all means.
I'll just go and get my camera.
You haven't yet had occasion to speak to my niece.
No, not yet. I have observed her, though.
Oh?
Yes, on the cliff top this morning. I usually take a walk before breakfast. I suddenly became aware of a woman sitting nearby, her arms drawn up about her knees, her face full of some dream. She was dressed all in black, but with great taste. It could only have been Mrs. Manderson. The lady is astonishingly beautiful.
Yes, in mind as well as body. Ah, look, here she is. Let me introduce you properly. Mabel, my dear.
Good morning, Uncle. And this is Mr. Trent?
Yes. Good morning, Mrs. Manderson.
I wish you success with your investigations.
I thank you.
Do you think you will succeed?
Oh, yes. Yes, I believe so, Mrs. Manderson. But I may find it necessary to consult you before my conclusions are published.
Of course.
In fact, may I ask you a question or two now? Nothing, I think, that you would rather not answer.
The inquest, Trent, that will be ordeal enough.
Uncle, I don't mind. Ask your questions, Mr. Trent.
Thank you. Your husband had in his desk an unusually large sum of ready money. Have you any idea why?
I can't imagine. But I'm very surprised to hear it.
Why surprised?
I thought my husband had very little money in the house. Because on Sunday night, just before he and Mr. Marlowe went out in the car, he came into the drawing room and asked if I could let him have some money until the next day. I gave him all I had in the house. It was about £30. He put it in his pocket.
He did not tell you why he wanted it?
No. He seemed to be irritated about something and said he hoped a drive in the car by moonlight might help him sleep. I remember thinking it odd that he should want money on a Sunday night. He usually kept about £100 by him. But I didn't pursue the matter. I'd forgotten all about it.
It was curious, certainly. Mrs. Manderson, when your husband went to bed that night, were you still awake?
No, I dozed off. I was half aroused by the light going on in the adjoining room. I was very drowsy, but I believe I asked what time it was and if he'd enjoyed his drive in the car.
And what time was it?
Oh, 11:30, he said. His usual bedtime. And he said he'd changed his mind about the drive.
Did he say why?
Yes. He said he'd sent Mr. Marlowe to Southampton to bring back some important information from a man who was leaving for Paris by the next day's boat. He said Marlowe could do the journey quite easily if he had no accident. Then he explained that he'd gone with Marlowe for a mile or so, and then walked home, and that he felt all the better for it. He was most forthcoming. Unusually so.
Which brings us, I fear, to a more painful subject.
guess.
Your relations with your husband.
Oh, Trent, I beg of you.
It's all right, Uncle. I'm sure the subject will come up at the inquest.
Oh, very well.
During the last few months of my husband's life, he changed towards me. And his attitude gave me great anxiety and sorrow. He'd become very reserved, mistrustful. He avoided my company.
And you?
Tried to work against it. Did all I could, with justice to my own dignity.
And you never asked him what was wrong?
No. I only made a point of being to him exactly as I had always been, so far as he'd allow me.
There were never any words between you?
Never. Hmm. Now, if that is all, I think we should be leaving, Uncle, if you'd give me your arm.
Yes.
Are you coming with us, Mr. Trent?
No, Trent isn't attending the court, Mabel. He's continuing his investigations here at the house.
Ah.
I'll see you later, Trent.
Yes.
Come along, my dear.
That is a wonderful woman, Mr. Trent.
Yes, indeed. Apropos of nothing in particular, were you at Oxford, Mr. Marlowe?
Yes. Why?
Just a guess. Who's Harris?
Harris? Oh, nobody knows, not even Banner. All I know is that when I was in London last week, I booked a deck cabin at Mr. Manderson's request for a Mr. George Harris on the boat that sailed on Monday.
And your errand to Southampton?
Manderson said he simply wanted me to find Harris and bring back a message from him. I was further told that Harris mightn't turn up. If he did, every moment was of importance.
But wasn't it an extraordinary thing to send you dashing off like that in the middle of the night?
It was about 10 o'clock, to be exact. Not that I'd have been surprised if he'd roused me out of my bed at midnight. Manderson had a taste for the dramatic. He'd suddenly decided that he wanted to have word from this man Harris. I accepted it, and that was that.
Why should he then have told Mrs. Manderson you were taking him for a midnight run?
I've no idea.
And Martin was told the same thing.
You know as much as I do, Mr. Trent. He came with me for a short way, then walked back. I drove on to Southampton. Mm. Now, if you'll excuse me, it's time I was going to the inquest.
One thing more, Mr. Marlowe.
Yes?
Just look at these. Closely, if you please.
They come from a diary, don't they? From the October pages for this year. Well, there's no writing on them.
Have you ever seen them before?
No. To my knowledge, nobody here has any such diary. Ah, a telegram.
Are you gentleman, Mr. Trent?
Yes, I am.
A telegram for you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Uh-huh.
It must be good news.
Not exactly news, Mr. Marlowe. It tells me only that another little guess of mine was right. Yes? Ah, couples. Come on in.
Thank you.
How did the inquest go?
Murder by person or persons unknown, as you expected.
Did Dr. Stock pass an opinion on the time of death?
He did. 6 to 8 hours before the finding of the body, based on rigor mortis. Why?
Well, to begin with, there are things that may hasten or retard the cooling of a body. Huh? This one was lying in long dewy grass on the shady side of the shed. As for rigidity, if Manderson died in a struggle or labouring under a sudden emotion, his corpse might stiffen practically instantaneously, particularly where there's damage to the skull. On the other hand, stiffening might not have begun until 8 or 10 hours after death. Excuse me.
Oh, sorry.
I want to get to the light.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
What are you doing?
However, what we can say is this. He wasn't shot at a time when people were awake, say, after 6:30 a.m. And since Martin sat up until about 12:30, that leaves us with about 6 hours during which the crime could have been committed. Unless...
Unless what?
Yes. This is a pretty good negative. Washed enough now, I think. Let's leave it to dry and get rid of all this mess.
What is all this?
Oh, it's called a hypo-eliminator. It's very useful when you're in a hurry with a negative. Did you know there's a very good dark room downstairs?
Trent, please tell me, what is going on?
Would you like to see a little bit of high-class police work? Now, just getting to the interesting bit, as you came in...
Well, yes,
now, can you, without touching it, tell me what this is?
Yes, of course I can. It's a small glass bowl. It looks like an ordinary finger bowl.
Right. Now, take this bottle,
mm-hmm.
Pull out the cork...
Right.
Excellent.
Do you recognise the powder inside?
No.
You swallowed pounds of it in your time. They give it to babies. No? No.
Well, it's grey powder is its ordinary name. Mercury and chalk. Oh, it's splendid stuff. Now, pour a little of the powder over this part of the glass bowl.
Huh?
Good. I can see you've done this before.
I haven't, I assure you. It's all a complete mystery to me.
Now I dust the powdered part of the bowl lightly with this camel hair brush. And what do you see?
Two large grey finger marks on the bowl. They weren't there before.
Allow me to explain. The human hand, even when quite clean, is never quite dry. And sometimes, in moments of anxiety, for instance, it's very moist. And when you pick up an object, like a finger bowl, you leave traces upon it which are practically invisible. That bowl was picked up by somebody with a rather moist hand, and quite recently, too. Now, if we sprinkle some of the powder on the outside of the bowl, so, the thumb mark comes to light. This is of the index finger, a single spiral whirl with deltas symmetrically disposed, and this, the print of the second finger, is a simple loop with a staple core and 15 counts. How do I know there are 15, you ask?
Well,
because I have the same two prints on this negative, which I've examined in detail. See for yourself. See the bifurcation of that ridge? Well, there it is, in the other. See that little scar near the centre? Well, there it is again.
Yes, I see.
They were clearly made by the same hand.
Oh, without doubt. Where did you photograph them?
On the inside of the left-hand leaf of the front window in Mrs. Manderson's bedroom. The bowl comes from Manderson's room. It contained his false teeth.
Then, presumably, they are Manderson's finger marks.
I wonder. Shall we see if we can match them once more? I believe we can.
Now what?
Lamp black. Now, do you know what this is?
It's a blank page from a diary.
My diary, to be precise. October. Right. Take the page in these tweezers. Oh, okay. I'll sprinkle some of the lamp black onto the surface of the paper. So. Now the other side. So. And there. Clearly printed in black.
The same two prints we saw on the bowl and the photographic negative.
Same man, you see. Well, couples, now I know. Now I know.
I'm still completely in the dark.
Why don't we go for a walk along the beach, my friend? I'll tell you the painful truth.
It all began with the shoes.
Whose shoes?
A pair of Manderson's, black patent leather. He'd been wearing them the evening before he died.
Well, what about them?
The stitching was split in such a way as to make me believe the shoes had been worn by someone for whom they were slightly too small.
Why should anyone wear them?
That is precisely what I asked myself, Cuffles. And suddenly, ideas rearranged themselves in my mind, and I found solutions to problems which had previously baffled me.
Such as?
Why was Manderson so untidily dressed when the body was found? Why were the cuffs dragged up inside the sleeves of the jacket? Why was his watch in the wrong pocket of his waistcoat? Why was he not wearing his false teeth? And more, why wasn't he heard as he left the house that morning? Why did nobody hear the struggle and the shot? I'll tell you why. It was not Manderson who was in the house that night.
Oh, but that's absurd.
Is it?
Well, people saw him at close quarters.
Ah, but did they? Mrs. Manderson spoke to him as he went to bed. Indeed, found him strangely forthcoming. But she never actually saw him, because the open door connecting her bedroom with his would have hidden him from her view.
Martin saw him. He said so at the inquest.
Martin thought he saw him. What in fact he saw was a man wearing Manderson's smoking jacket and broad-brimmed hat, hunched over a telephone.
He spoke to him.
Oh, yes, he did. Which gives us clues as to the man's identity. One, he was sufficiently closely connected to the dead man to be able to deceive both Martin and Mrs. Manderson. Two, he was roughly Manderson's build, though his feet were slightly larger. Three, he was a good actor and mimic. And four, he had a minute acquaintance with the ways of the household.
Why? Whoever he is, should he go through with this charade?
Because it was necessary for him to create the belief that Sigsbee Manderson was alive and in the house until sometime after midnight that Sunday.
And he wasn't?
No. Manderson was dead before the false Manderson came to the house.
Am I to conclude from this that you believe the false Manderson to be our murderer?
Mm. And a very cool customer into the bargain. He shoots Manderson, probably at some distance from the house.
Yeah, which would account for nobody hearing the shot.
Dumps the body by the shed, puts on Manderson's outer garments, and removes Manderson's false teeth. He then walks quietly to the house, ensuring that he makes clear footprints in the gravel of the path. On reaching the library, he helps himself to a stiff whiskey.
Well, that's hardly surprising.
He rings for Martin, successfully passing himself off as the man's employer. Oh. Then he shuts himself up in Manderson's bedroom and prepares convincing evidence of its having been occupied by Manderson himself. He places the shoes outside the bedroom drawer, throws Manderson's outer garments over a chair, puts the denture in the bowl by the bedside, selects a suit, a pair of shoes and a tie from Manderson's wardrobe. While he's doing this, he hears the sound that he's dreading most, the drowsy voice from the adjoining room. Once again, as with Martin, he successfully mimics Manderson's voice and then settles down until he's sure Mabel Manderson is sleeping soundly. He then leaves the house on tiptoe by way of Mrs. Manderson's window, knowing that Martin will be alert and on duty downstairs, awaiting the expected telephone call.
That doesn't make sense, Trent. It was the impostor himself who instructed Martin to wait out. Now, why?
He needed an alibi.
Marlowe? Oh, not Marlowe.
Oh, yes. John Marlowe's presence in Southampton at 6:30 the following morning provided an airtight alibi only if the murder was assumed to be committed sometime after 12:30. It would be physically impossible for the car, a 15-horsepower four-cylinder Northumberland, to get to Southampton by 6:30 unless it left Marston by midnight at the latest.
So, Marlowe quietly leaves the house by way of my niece's window, dresses Manderson's body in the brown suit he's taken from the wardrobe,
making several crucial mistakes in the process.
And drives off at high speed to Southampton.
Precisely.
There could be no doubt about it, I suppose.
Unfortunately, none. The fingerprints on the glass bowl and on the window are definitely Marlowe's. Also, I sent a telegram to a personal friend who's a fellow of a college at Oxford, asking if John Marlowe had any connections with acting while at the university.
And?
I received his reply this morning. Marlowe was a member of the Oxford University Dramatic Society for 3 years, played Bardolph, Cleon and Mercutio, excelled in character acting and imitations, and was the hero of some famous hoaxes.
Conclusive, then?
I think so.
And his motive for murdering Manderson?
Remains to be seen.
Trent. What do you intend to do?
The first thing must be to write all this up for the newspaper. And then...
Yes?
And then I must nerve myself for what may prove to be a most distressful interview.
Good morning, Mr. Trent.
Good morning.
Please, do come in and sit down.
Thank you.
You look wretchedly tired.
I've been working half the night on my final report to the record and thinking hard for the rest.
Your final report?
I have it here in this envelope.
You know the identity of the murderer?
Oh, yes.
Well, then...
Mrs. Manderson, forgive me, but first, may I ask you some further questions?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course.
Is it true that you have no idea why your late husband changed his attitude to you?
I've told you so already, Mr. Trent. And I said so again at the inquest.
I do not believe you.
You're accusing me of perjury?
I am accusing you of not telling the whole truth. I need to know.
Very well. The whole truth, however painful. Our marriage wasn't a very successful one. I was only 20. He was the only strong man I had ever known. But it didn't take me long to realize that he cared more for his business than he did for me. His main purpose in marrying me, I think, was to have at his side a wife who would take an important place in society, do credit to his position in the world. And I found I couldn't.
Please continue.
Can you think what it means to step out of a world where there was always some creative work in the background. Work with some dignity about it. Men and women with professions or arts to follow, ideals to believe in. Some of them wealthy, some of them poor. Can you think what it means to step out of that world into another where you have to be rich, shamefully rich, to exist at all? Where money is the only thing that counts, and the women live for display and silly amusements and silly immoralities. It was so empty. I did try to adjust. I went on trying. And I never told him how I felt. But I was a total failure. I used to steal holidays now and then, and with old school friends, perhaps, who couldn't afford to travel. Or I'd stay in London quietly with people who'd known me all my life, and we'd tell each other about cheap dressmakers and sit in cheap seats at the theatre. They were my happiest times.
And your husband discovered this?
It happened last year. I don't know how. Some woman may have suggested it to him, because the women all understood, of course. Anyway, he said nothing to me, but I sensed that he knew, and after a while we were just being polite and considerate to each other, and I felt the whole basis of our living together was going under my feet. Then at last it was gone.
And that is the whole truth?
Yes. You still don't believe me?
Oh, I want to.
But?
I have to ask you one last brutal question.
Yes?
Mrs. Manderson, will you solemnly assure me that your husband's change towards you had nothing to do with jealousy towards John Marlowe?
Oh.
I need your assurance, Mrs. Manderson. That is all I wanted to know. I'll leave my manuscript on the table. Do what you like with it. As far as I'm concerned, the case is closed. I'm deeply sorry.
My dear couples, I have cut and run. What else could I do? I love your niece. I've loved her from the first moment I saw her. She's all you said of her and more, much more. I'd resolved at our first meeting to take you every step of the way, and I'll do so now, even though it causes us both pain. You asked about Marlowe's motive. It was love. His love for Mabel Manderson.
Obsessed by his passion for her, and witnessing every day the evidence of her unhappiness, he planned and then performed Manderson's murder. Murder, for a woman's sake, is, heaven knows, not all that rare a crime. But it needed all his intelligence and all his daring. Did it also require your niece's complicity? That is the dread question I've asked myself a thousand times. Did she know the murder was brewing and keep silent? Or worse, did she plan it with him, assist him in his escape through her bedroom window? Was she even the ruling spirit in the crime? I fancy not. In her presence, I have felt an inward certainty of her ultimate goodness of heart. I can believe that in her destitution she turned to that graceful and handsome young man, but I cannot believe that she had any knowledge of his deadly purpose. You know her better than I do. I'm sure you will believe the same. I have left my manuscript with her to do with as she wishes, and I have returned Sir James's cheque. In the circumstances, it seemed the only honourable thing to do. I see no chance of anybody else hitting on the solution to the crime, so it is our secret alone, and I have no doubt that you will share my wish that it remain so. I must try to get her out of my mind, so I have asked Sir James to send me somewhere, anywhere, as the Record's own correspondent. I leave tomorrow for Curland and Livonia to cover the revolt. They say time heals. I hope and pray it may be so.
Goodbye, my dear old friend. Yours, I, Philip Trent.
Thank you. By all that's holy, if it isn't Mr. Trent.
What? Good day to you, sir.
Mr. Bunner.
Yes, sir. Calvin C. Bunner at your service.
What are you doing in Paris?
Well, sir, I am now resident here as the chief continental agent of the Madison Company and fully satisfied with that position and its prospects. I may add that life is a great deal quieter now I'm no longer at Madison's beck and call 24 hours a day. No disrespect to the deceased intended. And what brings you to Paris, Mr. Trent?
I'm working for the Record full-time these days. I don't seem able to paint. I've not been in England for a year, as a matter of fact. I have quite lost touch.
Is it a year since the murder? My, my.
Tell me, whatever became of Manderson's other secretary, John Marlowe?
Oh, I can bring you right up to date with John. We're in constant contact, and we're even planning a holiday together this summer. That's if he can tear himself away from his fiancée.
He's engaged to be married?
That's right. A lovely girl. Irish. She'll make him a wonderful wife. John's running his father's business these days and really putting it on the map. He has a fine head on his shoulders, and when he's gotten himself more experience, he'll be up there with the smartest in the land. Mr. Trent, you still with me?
I'm sorry. I thought...
You thought what?
No matter. Mr. Bunner.
Yeah?
What news of... of Mrs. Manderson?
Oh, can't help you much there, I'm afraid. She left England immediately after the settlement of her husband's affairs, and I believe she lived for some time in Florence, Italy.
Is she still there, do you know?
No, I believe she returned to London, sold up the house in Mayfair, and bought a smaller one out Hampstead way, where she lives quietly alone, hardly venturing into society. Seems a crime, doesn't it? All those good hard dollars just waiting for someone to spraddle them around.
So she was a beneficiary under Manderson's will?
Oh, I'll say. He left her more than half his wad. Why, she has money to burn. Just think of the fear she might make in the world. But nothing doing. Do you know, Mr. Trent, she is the best woman I ever met. But she just could never seem to get the habit of spending money. Mr. Trent, are you still with me?
Forgive me. I can already see the white cliffs above Dover.
You're returning to London?
At once. Thank you, Mr. Bunner.
What for?
Everything.
Yes, I'm coming. Burton Couples.
Hello, Couples. It's Philip Trent.
My dear boy, where are you speaking from?
I'm back in London.
Welcome home.
Couples, I need to speak to your niece.
Aha.
I think we should meet in private and alone.
How do you know?
I realize it's presumption on my part approaching you after what I said about Mabel in my letter. You'd be fully entitled to refuse me, but it is desperately important to me, and we've been friends for a long time.
There's no need to be abject, dear boy. I'll get her to invite you to tea.
Mrs. Manderson, may I say something?
Please do.
It is about what occurred at our last meeting. Do you remember?
I shall never forget.
Well, I owe you an apology. I realize now that what I thought about you was not true.
No.
And I cannot imagine how such suspicions could ever have entered my head.
There's no need to apologize. You were right up to a point.
How?
I can see now that my late husband's actions that night, his attitude towards me during the last few months of his life, were prompted by jealousy towards John Marlowe, as you suspected.
But quite without reason.
I've thought about it a great deal. And all I can think of are little things. For instance, one day he asked me what I most liked about Mr. Marlowe, and I said, his manners. And he gave me a black look and said, yes, Marlowe is a gentleman, not looking at me. Then a while later, Mr. Marlowe fell in love with Alice, an American girl who was the most unprincipled flirt I ever knew. She made a complete fool of him. So, one day, I asked him to row me in a boat on the lake. And in the boat, I told him the truth about Alice. He took it admirably, but didn't believe me a bit. Anyway, when we got back, my husband helped me out of the boat, and though he joked at the time, he was reserved and silent that evening. And he looked so wretched the next day at breakfast that I thought he was ill. Soon after, Mr. Marlowe showed me a note that he'd received from Alice, asking him for his congratulations on her engagement. He was deeply upset. I put my hand on his arm just as my husband came into the room. He looked at us and turned and walked quietly back into his study. He then went away for a week on business, and
When he returned, he was looking white and strange, and as soon as he saw me, he asked where Mr. Marlowe was. I should have realized the truth then, but I didn't.
And that is all there was between you?
Yes. Mr. Marlowe's a little younger than I am, and for all his cleverness, I looked on him practically as a boy. He was so vulnerable, so amiable, so lacking in ambition. I felt protective towards him, as one might towards a younger brother. And that, at last, is the whole truth.
You see before you a man dressed in the scrubbiest sackcloth made and daubed with the grittiest ashes. But I do have one more question.
Ask it, by all means.
You have my manuscript incriminating Mr. Marlowe. Why have you never used it?
Because I know he's innocent.
Innocent? But all the evidence...
Evidence of what? He impersonated my husband that night, escaped by my bedroom window and thereby established an alibi. I don't see those things can be doubted, but that's all. I knew Mr. Marlowe constantly for several years, and I know him to be incapable of a crime of bloodshed. He hated physical violence. It would be impossible for him deliberately to take another man's life.
It is still conceivable he killed by accident or in self-defense.
Yes. I've thought it over till my head aches, and I can see no solution to the mystery. All I am clear about is that John Marlowe isn't a murderer, and that if it ever came to court, the judge and jury would probably think he was. So I've simply let it alone.
There's only one thing for it. I must see Marlowe. Do you know where I might find him?
No. But I dare say Uncle Burton could tell you. He met Mr. Marlowe a while ago in London, and they talked. Personally, I never saw him again after you left White Gables. Though I'm sure you'll have assumed otherwise. What did you suppose had happened to Mr. Marlowe after you had withdrawn from the scene?
I supposed that you would have married him and gone to live abroad.
In genteel poverty?
I beg your pardon?
Mr. Marlowe had no money then. And under the terms of the will, if I marry again, I lose everything my husband left me.
I had no idea.
On the whole, I'm glad of it. For one thing, it spared me from a good many attentions of a kind a woman in my position frequently has to put up with.
And the other kind?
Ah, trouble me even less. I haven't yet met a man silly enough to want to marry a widow with luxurious habits and tastes and very little money.
Haven't you, by heaven? Then I'm going to show you that human passion is not always stifled by the smell of money. I am not afraid to make a fool of myself. Look at me. It is the sight of the century. It is one who says he loves you and would ask you to give up very great wealth to stand at his side. You have never been out of my thoughts since the time I first saw you. It was only your beauty that filled my mind then, but later I came to know your stronger magic, and it has been with me ever since.
Mr. Trent, please stop. Where is your self-restraint?
Gone. Gone. It has got right away. I am going after it in a minute. I don't care so much now. I love you, honor you, hold you dearest of all the world. There. I have finished. Now you give me leave to go.
No, Philip. I very much want you to stay.
How do you suppose he'll receive us?
Well, Couples, that rather depends.
You still think he's guilty, don't you? I'm sure he isn't.
And so is Mabel.
He had no motive, did he? It was all in Manderson's mind.
He still has a number of questions to answer.
Mr. Trent, Mr. Couples.
Good evening, Mr. Marlowe.
Please come through, by the way.
Please make yourselves comfortable.
Thank you,
Mr. Marlowe.
Are you here as a witness, Mr. Couples, or merely moral support?
As an interested party, Mr. Marlowe, nothing more.
You've read Mr. Trent's manuscript?
Yes, I'm aware of its contents.
Mr. Couples and I discussed the matter fully before I left Marlston.
I've read it three times. It's an astonishing document, Mr. Trent. You've got at so much of the truth.
Thank you. There are still some pieces missing, which we are looking to you to provide.
In my own defense?
Listen, I still have no reason to doubt the conclusions I came to regarding the events of that night and your involvement in them.
You wore Manderson's shoes, you impersonated his voice, you made your escape through the window of Mrs. Manderson's bedroom, all in a determined attempt to establish an alibi. Why?
Let me tell you the facts of what happened that night. Bunner and I dined with the Mandersons, rising from the table at about 9. Then Mrs. Manderson retired to the drawing room. Bunner went to visit a friend, and Manderson led me to the orchard behind the house, saying he wished to have a talk. He said there was a big thing on, and he wanted me to do him an important service.
Please continue.
Manderson asked me if I remembered the name George Harris. Yes, I said. On your instructions, I booked a cabin in that name on the boat that leaves Southampton at noon tomorrow. Whereupon he took a ticket from his wallet, handed it to me, and said, George Harris cannot leave England tomorrow. You must go in his place. I'm here to obey orders, I said. Yes, he said, but these aren't ordinary orders.
Mm-hmm.
The point is this. The deal I'm busy with will be ruined if anybody's aware of my involvement. So if my secretary is known to have crossed to Paris at this time, the game is up. Well, rather grudgingly, I agreed to do my best to conceal my identity. He then gave me a list of complicated instructions. What they amounted to was this. I was to take the car and set off for Southampton immediately, since no train would fit in. Once in Southampton, at about 6 the following morning, I was to proceed to the Bedford Hotel and inform Harris, if he was there, that I was to go to Paris in his stead.
And if he wasn't?
Well, that meant that he'd received Manderson's telegram and the plan would proceed without him. I was to leave the car at a garage under an assumed name, change my appearance, and travel by the boat as George Harris. In Paris, I was to take a room at the Hotel St. Petersburg, where I would, in the course of time, receive a message addressed to George Harris, instructing me where to take a locked wallet, which Manderson was going to give me.
And all this in the strictest secrecy?
Absolutely. Anyway, I threw a few necessaries into a suitcase and rejoined him in the library, where he handed me a stout leather letter case, about 8 inches by 6, fastened with a strap and with a lock on it. It just fitted into my side pocket. I was about to leave when I realized I only had a few shillings in my pocket. I suppose I should explain. I'd been keeping myself short of cash because, well, I'd been speculating, particularly on Wall Street, and, as Bunner put it, I'd been separated from my role.
You'd lost all your money?
The lot. And on that fatal Sunday night, Manderson knew that I was perfectly penniless. You should bear that fact in mind. Anyway, back to the story. I went to Manderson and asked for expenses for the journey. Immediately his hand went towards his hip pocket, where he usually kept a little case containing about £100. Then suddenly he checked and swore under his breath. I assumed that he'd mislaid his note case and reminded him that he had in his desk £1,000 in small notes, which I'd drawn for him. I suggested he should take my expenses out of that.
Yes.
He looked at me with such fury on his face, such hatred in his eyes. Then he said he'd get some money and I was to wait in the car. My mind was in turmoil. I'd never seen him behave like that before, though Bunner had told me of his sudden outbursts when they were alone.
So what did you do?
I stepped out onto the lawn and paced up and down, smoking a cigarette. Presently, I passed close to one of the drawing-room windows, and I noticed Mrs. Manderson's shadow on the thin silk curtain. Well, the window was open, and I heard her asking Manderson if £30 would be enough. He said it would do, and I heard the chink of money. Then he said, and I remember his words exactly, he said, I'm going out now. Marlowe has persuaded me to go for a moonlight run in the car. He says it'll help me sleep.
Your errand was secret. He told a little lie.
But Manderson never lied, even on the most insignificant matter. And yet, what had I just heard? A voluntary statement that was totally false. I was suddenly on my guard. My mind was racing. Why did he tell that lie? What had he done with the money? Why wasn't it in his desk? Gentlemen, I believe that lie saved me from being hanged as his murderer.
Hmm. Continue, please.
I stepped quickly to the car, where Manderson handed me a little under £30. He got in, and we drove off towards Bishopsbridge. At the gate to the golf course, a mile or so from the house, he said he would get out. I stopped the car. He asked me to repeat the instructions he'd given me. I did so. He said, goodbye, then, and stay with that wallet. I drove off, looking in the mirror as I did so. In it, for a moment, I saw Manderson's face. clear in the moonlight. It was the face of a triumphant madman. It was suddenly clear to me that he hated me insanely and was gloating over me, driving away to my fate.
And to what did you attribute this sudden hatred?
I've no idea. I still haven't. Who can plumb the depths of a madman's delusion?
You are convinced he was insane?
Oh, Mr. Trent, what sane man takes his own life to deliver someone he hates to the hangman?
You are saying that Manderson was responsible for his own death?
I am.
But there were no powder burns. And why
Suppose we have the story first, my dear chap, and discuss the details later.
Yes, of course. Of course, forgive me. Mr. Marlowe, please proceed.
There's a sharp bend in the road about 300 yards from where I set Manderson down, and once I was out of his sight, I stopped the car and got out. I suddenly knew where the money was, £1,000. It was in my pocket. The whole Paris business was a blind.
Yes! of course, I see.
Manderson would return to the house, phone the police, and tell them I'd taken his car and some money and was attempting to escape the country. They'd catch up with me in Paris if I got that far.
Living under a false name.
Wearing a disguise.
Having garaged the car under a false name.
And having travelled on the ferry in a cabin which I had booked in advance also under a false name.
The crime of a man who was desperately short of money.
And I was desperately short of money, and Manderson knew it.
Ingenious.
I took the letter case from my pocket, tore the staple out of the lock, and examined the contents in the headlights of the car.
Yes, Manderson's note case, £1,000, and two small wash leather bags containing uncut diamonds.
Exactly.
Good grief.
I knew instantly what I had to do. I turned the car, intending to catch up with Manderson before he reached the house and to tell him to his face what I thought of him. I was already travelling fast towards White Gables when I heard a shot in front of me and to the right. My first wild thought was that Manderson was shooting at me, and then I realized that the noise hadn't been close at hand, and I could see nobody in spite of the bright moonlight. As I reached the gate where I'd set Manderson down, I saw him. He was lying dead on the turf, clearly visible, just inside the gate.
On the golf course?
Obviously. The eighth green is just there.
Yes, he was on the green, quite close to the flag, his arms stretched out, and his eye... Well, you know, you saw it.
Yes.
Close by lay his soft black hat, and at his feet was what I soon identified as my revolver. Oh, for a few seconds I sat there helplessly staring at the body. Then I realized the appalling danger I was in. It wasn't prison Manderson had planned for me, but the scaffold. Yes. Do you play chess, Mr. Trent?
Yes, I do.
Why? I've played since I was a boy, and I'm pretty good. Manderson and I would play most evenings. He was brilliant. He planned his financial coups rather like a chess game and was a master of the unexpected. It occurred to me that he must have planned his death like a chess game, too, and that I must now do likewise if I wanted to get out of my predicament with a whole skin. And gradually the whole strange plan fell into place.
Were you so confident that you could imitate Manderson's voice?
No, I'd done it before and fooled Bannard.
It took great courage all the same.
I just needed to remain calm.
So you loaded the body into the car, drove back to White Gables and deposited him by the shed.
That's right. Then I put on his hat and outer garments.
Including the shoes.
Yes. They were painful all the time I wore them, but I knew that no footstep of mine must appear on the soft ground between the hut and the house. So I crammed my feet into them and just got on with the job. The rest, I think, you know.
It must have been a horrible business, dressing and undressing the body.
Yes. The worst part was getting his teeth out. But I was wriggling my head out of a noose. I knew it had to be done. Unfortunately, in my hurry, it seems I forgot to pull down his cuffs and put his watch in the wrong pocket, but I needed to get away if I was to be in Southampton by 6. And it was on that my alibi depended.
I think the occasional mistake is understandable given the circumstances. You'd drunk a fair amount of whiskey, too.
Oh, no, you're wrong about that. I'd had one stiff one, that's all. I poured the rest into a flask for the journey.
Ah.
I knew how important it was that I kept a clear head. There were so many things to do.
Indeed, you needed to clean the revolver and return it to your own room.
Replace the money and the diamonds in the desk.
Take off the shoes and place them outside Manderson's bedroom door.
Select a suit, tie and shoes for the body. Put his teeth in the bowl.
Leaving fingerprints as you did, sir.
Yes,
tumble the bed and make it look as if it had been slept in. And all this with Mrs. Manderson in the adjoining room.
Your worst moment must surely have been when she spoke.
Oh, yes, indeed. I knew it was a possibility, but I nearly lost my nerve all the same.
What I don't understand is why you needed to leave the house by way of her window. There were other rooms which were empty on that side of the house where there was little chance of being seen by Martin or by anybody else.
Oh, I hadn't the nerve. When I entered Manderson's room, I seemed to shut the door on half my terrace.
But what if Mrs. Manderson had remained awake?
I hoped and prayed she wouldn't. I knew her to be a sound sleeper. It seemed a reasonable risk to take. And I hadn't anticipated at that point that by using her window I would be laying her open to the charge of complicity in Manderson's murder. I'd have done anything rather than that. Well, gentlemen, that's my story.
Hmm. Well, Trent, are you satisfied?
Fully.
Well, let's go then. We've taken up enough of Mr. Marlowe's time. Goodbye, Marlowe.
Mr. Cupples.
For my part, I never thought you guilty for a moment.
Oh, thank you.
Goodbye, Marlowe. Oh, one last question.
Yes?
Suppose someone else had been put on trial for the murder.
I'd have taken my story to the lawyers for the defense and put myself in their hands.
Well, there's no chance of that now, I think. I was talking to Inspector Mertz at Scotland Yard this morning. There isn't a shred of evidence against anyone. The official view is that it was a case of revenge by some American Black Hand gang. So, that is the end of that. Mr. Marlowe, I am a man who has worked hard to put a rope around your neck. Will you shake hands? Thank you. Come along, Cupples. You are dining with me.
This is all very luxurious, Trent.
I come here only on special occasions. They do a saddle of mutton that's beyond compare.
Oh. And what are we celebrating this evening? The satisfactory conclusion to the Manderson affair?
No. No. This evening we are celebrating the fact that Mabel and I are to be married.
Oh, my dear friend, that is excellent news. Oh, I congratulate you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
May I say how earnestly I've hoped for this ever since receiving your letter. Mabel has seen so much unhappiness, but, oh, she'll make you a simply glorious wife.
I am sure of it. Now, what are we to drink? The wine here?
No, I think I'll have a milk and soda water.
What? A couple's not so loud. The waiter has a weak heart.
However, you order the wine by all means to mark the occasion, and I'll have a sip of yours.
As you wish. As you wish. Well, my dear friend, it's been an extraordinary case.
Yes, indeed.
Though one small detail of it still puzzles me.
What's that?
The marks on Manderson's wrists. I imagine he did it himself to suggest...
No. No, Trent. They happened in the struggle.
Struggle? What struggle?
When I was trying to wrest the gun from his hand.
You?
Yes. I shot Sigsby Manderson.
What?
It wasn't murder. On that night, I was taking my bedtime constitutional at about 10:15. I was nearly opposite the gate by the 8th hole on the golf course on the field path that runs behind White Gables when I heard a car coming. Then I heard it stop. I saw Manderson get out.
Yes?
As the car drove off again, to my great amazement, I saw him violently shake his fist at it. Then he went through the gate to the golf course and stood quite still on the 8th green. For a few moments he stood there with his head bent. Then his hand went to the pocket of his overcoat and he took out a revolver, which he held to his chest. I saw his face in the moonlight, and I knew at once he was insane.
You think he intended suicide?
Well, that's what I thought at the time. Perhaps he was only planning to wound himself. I don't know. Anyway, almost before I knew what I was doing, I leapt out of the shadows and seized his arm. He threw me off and pointed the gun at my head.
Good heavens.
And I managed to seize his wrists and hung on, fighting for my life. Somehow I tore the gun from his fingers. I never dreamt I had so much strength. And I retreated a few steps.
and he sprang for my throat. I fired blindly in his face. His knees gave way and he fell in a heap on the turf. I flung the revolver down and bent over him. And he was already dead. It was then that I heard the car returning. I hid.
You saw John Marlowe get out?
The whole time he was pacing up and down the green, I was within a few yards of him. I dare not show myself. I quarreled with Madison that morning in public in front of the hotel. I was bound to be suspected. Assuming that Marlowe would immediately call for the police and that they would think it a case of suicide, I dashed back to the hotel, climbed in through a rear window, and I ordered myself a cup of cocoa.
Oh, my dear old friend. Why on earth didn't you tell me this before?
I would have. I was on the point of doing so when you told me you suspected Marlowe, but...
But what?
Well, your case against him had been put together so ingeniously, I simply didn't have the heart. I resolved to make a clean breast of it in the following morning, but by then, you'd gone. Your letter clearly stated that you intended to take no further action in the case, so I let sleeping dogs lie. However, you do have my abject apologies and my assurance that if Marlowe had had to face charges, I'd have come forward straight away.
Oh, Couples. I am cured. You've beaten me. Huh? I shall never touch a crime mystery again. The Manderson affair will be Philip Trent's last case. Oh, there's just one thing I insist on.
What's that?
You shall pay for dinner.
In Trent's Last Case by E.C. Bentley, the cast was Philip Trent, Martin Jarvis, Mabel Manderson, Helena Breck, Marlowe, Simon Hewitt, Bunner, Brian Hewlett, and Couples, Manning Wilson, Inspector Murch, Alan Downer, Martin, Stephen Thorne, Sir James Molloy, Sean Barrett, and Mrs. Morgan, Joanna Wake, Figgis, Paul Gregory, Edison, David Goodland, Williams, Stuart Organ, Abbott, Simon Cuff, and Dr. Stock, Stephen Hattersley. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Trent's Last Case was dramatized for radio by Alan Downer and directed by Jerry Jones.
Martin Jarvis is currently appearing in Woman in Mind at the Vaudeville Theatre, London. And tomorrow evening at the same time, you can hear the last play in our Murder for Christmas series, Appleby's End by Michael Innes. It stars John Hurt, and he's surrounded by a remarkable cast. John Le Mesurier, Joyce Redman, and Pippa Gard are the Ravens, a very curious family whom Appleby encounters on a train. The title makes it sound very sinister, but this is perhaps the most light-hearted of Michael Innes' books about the inspector, and there's a lot of comedy as well as mystery in Michael Bakewell's dramatisation of Appleby's End, which you can hear as part of our Murder for Christmas series at 7:30 tomorrow evening. And looking a little further into the new year, next Wednesday evening at 7:45, Britain in ruins. It's not, as you might suppose, about the crime rate or the economy or housing shortages, but about the way we treat our historic ruins, the remains of once great castles, abbeys, stately homes and the like. For this programme, Malcolm Billings visited a number of ruins up and down the country, Fountains Abbey in North Yorkshire, Corfe Castle in Dorset, a castle in Cambridgeshire built a couple of centuries ago deliberately to look as though it was a medieval ruin, and everywhere he asked the same basic questions. Why do we preserve ruined buildings? Are we right to put money and care into the preservation of ruins, where there might be other projects crying out for attention? And what kind of ruins do we consider worth preserving, and why? That's Britain in Ruins with Malcolm Billings, next Wednesday evening at 7:45. Well, now back to this evening, and it's 9 o'clock, time for the Empresarios, which is introduced by the producer, Daniel Snowman.
Joan Sutherland in Meyerbeer's opera The Huguenots, the high point of a concert performance of this rarely produced work given in London's Royal Albert Hall one night in January 1968. And that event, and a score or more similar operatic spectaculars in the years since, would never have happened but for the periodic leaps of fantasy and faith by two larger-than-life impresarios, the designer Alan Sivright and the South African-born singer Denny Davis.
You have to finance it yourself, then you have to cast it, choose the work, and put the whole thing together, and then hold it together and pray God they're all going to be well on the night, that it will take off.
They may be only part-time impresarios, but Denny and Alan have been responsible over the years for concert performances of some of the great romantic operas featuring the world's most celebrated singers. From the very beginning of this extraordinary enterprise, they aimed right for the top with that dizzying performance of The Huguenots with Joan Sutherland.
When the whole thing was over and the party was...